Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today, we're undertaking an examination of, well, a really intricate relationship, the one between the Kurdish and Turkmen peoples.
Absolutely. It's a long and incredibly complex history of interaction between these two distinct ethnic groups, playing out across a particularly volatile region, Turkey, Iraq, and Syria especially.
And our aim today is really to unpack some of the key moments, the underlying factors that have shaped how they connect, you know, from times of coexistence within empires right through to the tensions and, frankly, the conflicts we see in the nation-state era.
Exactly. And we're drawing on a pretty comprehensive report for this, looking at everything through the lens of historical changes, the rise of nationalism, those competing territorial claims, which are huge state policies, and, of course, the significant role external powers have played right up to about 2024, 2025.
Okay, so let's start at the beginning. We need to establish who we're talking about.
Yeah.
Who exactly are the Kurds?
Right. So the Kurds are an Iranic ethnic group, and they're indigenous to the mountainous region we historically call Kurdistan. Today, that area is split mainly between Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria.
And they're a large group population-wise.
Oh, yes. They're the fourth largest ethnic group in West Asia. Global estimates put their numbers anywhere from 30 to maybe 45 million people.
Wow. And where are the main concentrations?
Primarily in Turkey estimates, they range quite a bit, maybe 14 to 20 million. Then Iran, around 8 to 12 million. Iraq has between, say, 5.5 and 8.5 million. And Syria, perhaps 1.5 to 3.6 million.
And culturally?
Religiously.
Predominantly Sunni Muslims, but there's significant diversity. You've got Shia communities, Alevis, Yazidis, Yarsen, and even smaller Christian and Zoroastrian groups. Historically, many were nomadic or semi-nomadic pastoralists, often with strong tribal structures.
But that changed. Yes, settlement became much more common after World War I. But the crucial thing to understand politically is that they're one of the world's largest stateless nations. Their aspirations for either their own state or significant autonomy have been, well, repeatedly blocked since the Treaty of Sevres back in 1920 was ultimately discarded.
And their identity is long established.
Definitely. Arab geographers recognized them as a distinct people as far back as the 10th century.
Okay, understood. Now let's turn to the Turkmen. How should we define them? And you mentioned they're distinct from the people in modern Turkmenistan.
Yes, that's a key point. Historically, the term Turkmen was used quite broadly for various Oghuz, Turkic tribes migrating west from Central Asia starting around the 11th century who converted to Islam.
So the ones in Iraq and Syria.
They are descendants of Turkic peoples who settled much later in Mesopotamia and the Levant, mainly during the Seljuk, Mamluk, and Ottoman periods. These weren't just random migrations. They were often state-sponsored for strategic reasons, controlling territory, military service, things like that.
Ah, okay. So different historical path than those who remained further east in what's now Turkmenistan.
Exactly. Shared Oghuz Turkic roots, yes. But their history and cultural development in Iraq and Syria took a very different course.
And where are these Iraqi and Syrian Turkmen populations mainly found today? What are the numbers like?
For Iraqi Turkmen, estimates generally fall between 2 and 3 million. For Syrian Turkmen, the estimates are, well, much wider, anywhere from 500,000 up to perhaps 3 million. It's harder to get precise figures there.
And their language and religion?
They speak distinct Oghuz Turkic dialects, influenced over time by Ottoman Turkish, Azerbaijani, and especially in Iraq since 2005, increasingly by modern standard Turkish from Turkey. Religiously, Iraqi Turkmen show quite a bit of diversity. Both Sunni and Shia communities are significant. Syrian Turkmen, on the other hand, are predominantly Sunni.
You mentioned earlier that the identity of Iraqi Turkmen is particularly nuanced. Could you expand on that a bit?
Yes, it's interesting. Iraqi Turkmen often report feeling a stronger cultural affinity with Azerbaijani Turks rather than Anatolian Turks from Turkey. They also tend to resist being seen simply as, you know, leftovers from the Ottoman Empire, a label sometimes applied politically.
And this idea of Turkmenali.
That's central. Their historical presence is deeply linked to this concept of Turkmenali, often envisioned as a belt of territory across northern Iraq. Think Kirkuk, Tal Afar, Erbil. It holds huge historical and symbolic weight for them, representing their ancestral lands and cultural heartland. This specific Iraqi experience really shapes their identity.
So we have these two distinct peoples, Kurds and Turkmen, often living side by side, geographically speaking. What makes understanding their relationship so important for the region?
It's precisely that geographic overlap, particularly in northern Iraq and Syria. Their histories are deeply intertwined, going back centuries through empires like the Ottomans. And then, crucially, after those empires fell, the new borders turned both groups into minorities within new nation-states. That shared experience is fundamental.
But sharing that experience of being a minority didn't automatically lead to solidarity, did it?
No, not consistently at all. Their interactions have really run the gamut. There were periods of cooperation, even alliances, especially early in the Ottoman era, against common enemies. But there have also been times of intense friction, even outright conflict.
Over what, mainly?
Competing claims over territory and resources are huge factors, especially in strategic, resource-rich areas like Kirkuk. That's been a major source of tension. And you have to remember, both groups have faced serious marginalization, assimilation policies, denial of basic rights, and even state-sponsored violence at different times.
Yet that shared vulnerability didn't forge a strong alliance.
Often not. State policies have frequently manipulated the relationship, sometimes deliberately playing one group against the other. External actors, regional powers, they've also played a significant role in exacerbating tensions. So getting a handle on this complex dynamic is really essential if you want to understand the factors driving stability or instability in the region.
Okay, let's dig into the history a bit more then. Before the 20th century, how did these groups first encounter each other? What were the settlement patterns?
Well, the Kurdish presence in their homeland goes back millennia, potentially linked to groups known from ancient Mesopotamian times. Turkmen arrival was much later, starting significantly in the 11th century with the Seljuk Empire's expansion.
And the Seljuks settled them strategically.
Yes, very much so. They established Turkmen communities in key spots in northern Iraq, places like Talifar, Erbil, and crucially, Kirkuk. This really laid the foundation for that later idea of Turkmenelli. They also settled Turkmen in parts of Syria.
Did that pattern continue with later rulers?
It did. Subsequent powers like the Zengids and the Mamluks kept settling Turkmen in Syria, often using them for military service to bolster control. Then the Ottoman conquest in the 16th century really ramped up Turkmen settlement in both Syria and northern Iraq.
Why did the Ottomans do that? What was the strategy?
Multiple reasons. For administrative control, securing vital trade routes, acting as a counterweight to powerful Bedouin tribes, and serving as garrison troops in key locations. Kirkuk, for instance, really flourished as an important Ottoman administrative and cultural hub with a very significant Turkmen role.
So this long history created these ethnically mixed zones.
Precisely. Centuries of overlapping settlements in northern Iraq and Syria resulted in these areas where different groups lived in close proximity, which is still a defining characteristic today.
All right, let's focus on that Ottoman period then, roughly 16th century up to the early 20th. How did Ottoman rule specifically shape the Kurdish-Turkmen relationship?
It had a huge complex impact. Initially, with the Kurds, there was a kind of strategic alliance. The Kurds were predominantly Sunni, facing the rising Shia Safavid Empire in Iran. The Ottomans were also Sunni, so the Kurds largely sided with the Ottomans.
And that was important militarily.
Absolutely critical. Kurdish support was decisive in the Battle of Çıldıran in 1514 against the Safavids. As a result, and really as a pragmatic way to govern these remote, mountainous eastern regions, the Ottomans granted considerable semi-autonomy to many Kurdish emirates.
What did that autonomy look like?
Things like hereditary rule within the emirates, certain tax exemptions. It was a practical arrangement that actually lasted for over three centuries, providing a degree of stability.
But it didn't last forever.
No. By the mid-19th century, things changed. The Ottomans started implementing the Tanzimat reforms, aiming for modernization and, crucially, centralization of power. This directly challenged that traditional Kurdish autonomy.
Leading to conflict.
Yes, it led to increased Kurdish resistance and several revolts as the Ottomans tried to dismantle the old system. There was a brief period of improved relations under Sultan Abdulhamid II. Later on, he used pan-Islamism and incorporated Kurdish tribes into his Hamidi cavalry regiments. But the long-term trend was clear. Kurdish autonomy was eroding. Their status depended entirely on Ottoman priorities.
Okay, so that's the Kurdish experience. What about the Turkmen under the Ottomans during the same time? Was it different?
Generally, yes. It seems quite different. While the Kurds had this conditional, often remote autonomy, Turkmen communities often saw their numbers and influence increase under the Ottomans. They were frequently settled in those strategic areas we mentioned, served in garrisons, helped maintain security.
So, more integrated.
It appears so. Turkmen individuals and families became prominent in local administration, trade, and cultural life, especially in key cities like Kirkuk. They often benefited from the Ottoman state's reinforcement of Turkish identity and the Hanafi school of Sunni Islam. So while Kurds had autonomy, Turkmen seem more directly woven into the Ottoman administrative and military fabric.
You mentioned the Ottomans even used different terms for them.
That's right, an interesting detail. The Ottomans apparently referred to the Kurds as the Black Nation and the Turkomans as the Gray Nation. It perhaps reflects these different ways they were incorporated or perceived within the empire.
That differing status, that different relationship with the central power, seems like it could easily create friction down the line.
Absolutely. Several Ottoman strategies, perhaps unintentionally, sowed the seeds for future problems. First, the classic imperial tactic of using one group against another, Kurds against Safavids initially, maybe Turkmen as a check on Kurdish or Bedouin power later. That builds mistrust.
And the settlements.
The settlement policy itself. Placing Turkmen communities, sometimes explicitly as pacifiers, near or within Kurdish areas, creating a built-in basis for later disputes over land and resources. Kirkuk is the prime example of where this played out.
And the loss of Kurdish autonomy.
That was crucial. When the 19th century centralization efforts dismantled that long-standing Kurdish autonomy, it removed the very foundation that had allowed for earlier periods of, if not harmony, at least accommodation. It created new grievances, new resentments that would carry into the next century.
It really sets the stage for the turbulence to come. Oh, that, yes?
Oh.
Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosch. Hannah. Oh, wow, Hannah, this smells absolutely incredible today. Did you use a new spice blend? It smells warmer somehow.
It does smell particularly good today. You can definitely pick up something extra in there. Very inviting.
Right. It's got this wonderful warmth. You know, after digging into all that complex imperial history, a good cup of chai feels essential right now.
Yeah.
This one feels really soothing. The spice balance is spot on, not bitter at all today. You really need to try this.
I definitely will. A little moment of aromatic peace, as you say.
Exactly. Okay, well, let's take a quick break, enjoy this fantastic chai, and when we come back, we'll dive into the massive changes of the 20th century and how the rise of nation-states completely reshapes the Kurdish-Turkmen relationship.
Sounds like a very welcome pause. Looking forward to it.
All right, we are back, feeling suitably refreshed thanks to Hannah's excellent chai. Ready to tackle the 20th century?
Ready. And it's a period of profound upheaval for both groups.
So the Ottoman Empire collapses after World War I. New borders are drawn. How did that fundamentally change things for Kurds and Turkmen?
It changed everything. The end of the empire sparked nationalist hopes among many groups. The initial Treaty of Sevres in 1920 actually proposed an autonomous Kurdish state.
But that never materialized, right?
No. It was fiercely opposed by the Turkish national movement led by Ataturk. The later Treaty of Lausanne in 1923, which set modern Turkey's borders, made zero mention of Kurdish autonomy. It effectively carved up historical Kurdistan among four new states, Turkey, Iraq, Iran, and Syria.
Turning Kurds into a huge stateless minority overnight, essentially.
Precisely, one of the largest in the world. And similarly, the Turkmen communities in northern Iraq and Syria suddenly found themselves minorities in new Arab-dominated states. They were cut off politically and geographically from Turkey, the state they shared linguistic and cultural ties with.
And these new borders must have been incredibly disruptive on the ground.
Hugely. They cut across traditional nomadic routes, trade networks, family connections, and crucially, both Kurds and Turkmen were now subject to the nation-building projects of these new states.
Which usually meant trying to create a single, unified national identity.
Exactly. Often at the expense of minority rights, languages, and cultures, assimilation became a major pressure.
Okay, let's look at Turkey first. How did the new Turkish Republic under Ataturk deal with its large Kurdish population?
The approach was rooted in a very strong Turkish nationalism and secularism. The Kemalist ideology aimed to forge a homogeneous Turkish nation, and this meant essentially denying ethnic differences. Kurds were officially classified as Mountain Turks.
Mountain Turks, as in Turks who'd just forgotten they were Turkish.
That was the official line, yes. The words Kurd and Kurdistan were banned in public life. The Kurdish language was severely suppressed, no schools, no publications, no public use. The 1924 constitution made Turkish the sole official language.
It sounds like a direct attempt to erase Kurdish identity.
It was a systematic policy of assimilation, absolutely. Laws were passed to enable land expropriation from Kurds, and the 1934 resettlement law aimed to forcibly relocate and disperse Kurdish populations into Turkish-majority areas to speed up assimilation. There is even the 1935 Tunceli Law specifically targeting the Dersim region for Turkification.
And how did the Kurds react to this?
With resistance. These policies led directly to major Kurdish revolts in the 1920s and 30s, Sheikh Zed, Ararat, Dersim. All were brutally suppressed by the Turkish military, often with devastating consequences for civilians.
And this history is the root of the modern conflict.
Without a doubt. The modern Kurdish-Turkish conflict, particularly the PKK insurgency starting in 1984, grew directly out of this legacy of repression and denial of basic rights and identity. It's a conflict that has cost tens of thousands of lives, caused massive displacement, village destruction, and involved highly controversial state counterinsurgency tactics.
Let's shift to Iraq. What happened there under the British mandate and the early Iraqi state? How did Kurds and Turkmen fare?
Well, the British created Iraq, including the disputed Mosul Vilayet, which contained Kirkuk and its oil, despite Turkish claims and some initial Turkmen resistance. The British were apparently a bit suspicious of the Turkmen early on, maybe due to their Ottoman ties.
But were they recognized at all?
Yes, initially. The 1925 Iraqi constitution did recognize Turkmen alongside Arabs and Kurds, and a 1931 law allowed for the use of Kurdish and Turkish languages in administration in areas like Kirkuk and Kifri, where they had significant populations.
So some early recognition, but did it last?
No, their status eroded over time, and Kirkuk became the absolute focal point, the oil, obviously, but also its historical importance for both groups. The demographics there also started changing as the oil industry grew, attracting many Kurdish workers.
What did the numbers look like around mid-century?
The 1957 census is key here. It showed Turkmen were the largest single group in Kirkuk City, about 37.6%. Kurds were second at 33.3%, but in the wider Kirkuk governorate, Kurds were the majority. So you can see the seeds of conflicting claims right there.
And this demographic tension boiled over?
Tragically, yes. In July 1959, there were riots in Kirkuk specifically targeting Turkmen looters. It left incredibly deep scars and bitterness in the Turkmen community. Meanwhile, Iraqi Kurds were fighting their own battles for autonomy against Baghdad.
Then came the Ba'athists in the late 60s. How did that change things?
It was a disaster for both groups, particularly in the north. The Ba'ath regime launched systematic Arabization campaigns. The goal was explicit: change the demographics in Kirkuk and other northern areas to favor Arabs and cement Baghdad's control, especially over the oil.
How did they do that?
Forced displacement on a massive scale. Hundreds of thousands of Kurds and Turkmen were driven out, their lands confiscated. Arab families from the south were moved in to take their place. Non-Arabs faced immense pressure to legally change their ethnicity to Arab. Turkmen, just like the Kurds, faced purges, discrimination, and the denial of their cultural rights during this brutal period.
What about Syria? Under the French mandate and then independence, what was the situation for Kurds and Turkmen there? Similar pressures?
Yes, similar pressures of marginalization, though the specifics differed. The French mandate also drew borders that divided communities. Some Kurdish refugees fleeing Turkey did get citizenship in the Jazeera region in the northeast. But crucially, neither Kurds nor Turkmen got any constitutional guarantees for language or cultural rights, not under the French, nor under the later independent Syrian governments.
And post-independence.
Successive Syrian governments pushed Arab nationalism quite hard, which meant marginalizing non-Arabs. Both Kurdish and Turkmen languages and cultures faced assimilation pressures. Under Hafez al-Assad, things got tougher. Turkish publications were banned, for example.
And wasn't there a specific incident affecting Kurdish citizenship?
Yes, a notorious one. The 1962 census in Al-Hasakah governorate. Tens of thousands of Kurds were arbitrarily stripped of their Syrian citizenship, just like that. They became stateless, known as Ajanib foreigners in their own land.
So before the civil war in 2011, both were essentially unrecognized minorities facing similar issues.
Largely, yes. Both face cultural suppression, political exclusion, economic disadvantage, particularly in the northern regions where they were concentrated.
But again, this shared marginalization didn't necessarily create a united front.
No. Their specific histories were different. Their relationship with state power varied. They had competing local interests. Again, think land, especially around Kirkuk in Iraq. But similar dynamics existed elsewhere. And crucially, they often had different external backers or alignments. So no automatic solidarity.
Which brings us to the more contemporary period, late 20th century up to today. Where do things stand now? What are the main friction points? Let's start back in Iraq.
Iraq, and specifically Kirkuk, remains absolutely central and highly volatile. It's this nexus of contested identity, resources, primarily oil, and raw political power.
How did the different groups frame their claims there?
Well, Kurdish political discourse often calls Kirkuk the Jerusalem of Kurdistan. They emphasize historical presence and point to that 1957 census showing a Kurdish majority in the wider governorate. Iraqi Turkmen see it as their historical and cultural capital, highlighting Ottoman-era prominence and their plurality in the city itself in 1957, and Arab communities also assert their own historical ties.
And the legacy of Arabization complicates everything.
Massively. Those Ba'athist policies that forced out Kurds and Turkmen and brought in Arabs between the 60s and 2003 created deep wounds and competing claims over property and belonging. After 2003, when many Kurds returned, you heard accusations of Kurdification from Turkmen and Arabs.
And control shifted after 2003.
Yes. From 2014 to 2017, after Iraqi forces withdrew ahead of ISIS, Kurdish Peshmerga effectively controlled Kirkuk. During that time, there were reports of Arabs and Turkmen feeling marginalized.
Then came the KRG independence referendum in 2017.
Right. The KRG included Kirkuk in that referendum, which Baghdad saw as completely unacceptable. Iraqi federal forces moved in, retook control, and this led to another wave of displacement, mostly Kurds this time. The power balance shifted again, often seen as empowering Arab and Turkmen factions allied with Baghdad at the expense of the Kurds. And concerns about renewed Arabization efforts surfaced again.
What about that constitutional article meant to resolve Kirkuk's status, Article 140?
Still stuck, completely stalled. It was supposed to involve normalization, a census, then a referendum, but it hasn't happened. Land disputes are ongoing, too, related to those Ba'ath-era confiscations and post-2003 returns. And hovering over everything is the massive oil wealth. It just fuels the competition.
What did the last provincial elections in Kirkuk show, the ones in December 2023?
A very fragmented result. No single ethnic bloc, Kurdish, Arab, or Turkmen, won a clear majority. It highlighted just how divided the political landscape is there.
Beyond Kirkuk, what's the broader political dynamic like between Kurdish groups and Turkmen groups in Iraq?
Often quite tense. Relations between the KRG, especially the KDP party, and the main Iraqi Turkmen party, the ITF, which gets strong backing from Turkey, are frequently strained. The ITF generally opposes Kurdish control in Kirkuk and other disputed areas.
Have Kurdish parties tried to limit ITF influence?
Historically, yes, there have been efforts to sideline the ITF, but it's not monolithic. Some Turkmen politicians and smaller parties do participate within the KRG system.
And are the Turkmen united themselves?
No, there are significant internal divisions, mainly along Sunni-Shia lines. Sunni Turkmen tend to align more with the ITF and Turkey. Shia Turkmen often have closer ties to parties in Baghdad and, indirectly, Iran.
And Kurdish infighting affects this, too.
Definitely. The rivalry between the two main Kurdish parties, the KDP and the PUK, impacts Kirkuk politics significantly, partly because they have different external relationships.
And the impact of ISIS.
Devastating for everyone in the region. Turkmen faced particular atrocities, leading some observers to talk about potential genocide. Even post-ISIS, security is shaky, and the presence of various PMUs or popular mobilization units, some including Turkmen fighters, adds another layer of complexity.
So what's the immediate situation in Kirkuk now, in 2024-2025?
Still deadlocked politically after those 2023 elections. There was a controversial election for governor in August 2024, a PUK figure won, but the KDP, ITF, and Sunni Arabs boycotted it. Deep divisions.
Any proposals to break the deadlock?
There was talk of a rotating governorship, an idea backed by the ITF, but the PUK resisted it. Then there was the national census in November 2024, also controversial, with claims it was manipulated to boost Kurdish numbers in disputed areas. Land disputes persist despite a new property restitution law, and underpinning it all is that external influence. Turkey backing the ITF and Sunni Arabs, Iran backing Shia parties and Shia Turkmen elements in the PMUs.
Okay, let's pivot to Syria. The civil war there has obviously been catastrophic. How did it specifically impact Kurdish-Turkmen relations?
It fundamentally reshaped them and made them much more adversarial in many ways. From the start of the war in 2011, Syrian Turkmen largely joined the opposition against Assad. They formed armed brigades, many with strong Turkish nationalist leanings, like the Sultan Murad Brigade.
And they got Turkish support.
Significant support arms, training. Eventually, many integrated into the Turkish-backed umbrella group, the Syrian National Army, or SNA.
At the same time, Kurdish groups were establishing autonomy.
Yes. The PYD party and its armed wing, the YPG, later the core of the multi-ethnic Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF carved out an autonomous region in the north and east known as AAS or Rojava, starting around 2012, And critically, they got U.S. backing in the fight against ISIS.
So you had Turkish-backed Turkmen groups and U.S.-backed Kurdish-led groups often in the same areas.
Exactly. And that became the defining conflict dynamic. Kurdish-Turkmen relations got largely subsumed into the wider Turkey versus PYD-SDF conflict. Wow. Turkish-backed Turkmen brigades frequently clashed with the SDF along the border.
Was the SDF purely Kurdish?
No, it included Arabs, Assyrian Syriacs, even some Turkmen individuals and units. But the leadership was predominantly Kurdish, and Turkey viewed the entire project as an extension of the PKK, which it considers a terrorist organization. So despite some Turkmen participation in the SDF, the overarching relationship became hostile, driven by Ankara's opposition.
Were there abuses?
There were reports of displacement and mistreatment of Turkmen by YPG forces in some contested areas. Then Turkey launched several major military interventions into Syria, Euphrates Shield, Olive Branch, Peace Spring.
What was Turkey's goal with those?
Explicitly to push the SDF away from the border and create buffer zones controlled by Turkey and its SNA proxies, including those Turkmen brigades. These Turkish-controlled zones have since faced numerous accusations of human rights violations.
How do Syrian Turkmen generally view the Kurdish Autonomy Project, the AKNEs? Is there one perspective?
Likely very polarized. Those aligned with the SNA in Turkey are vehemently opposed. They see it through Ankara's lens, a PKK-linked threat to Syrian unity.
And Turkmen living within AKNE's areas?
Their views are probably much more varied. The AKNEs framework talks about multi-ethnic coexistence and decentralization democratic confederalism. Some Turkmen might find space within that. Others might resent Kurdish dominance. There isn't really a single unified Turkmen voice speaking on this.
What's the latest on the ground in Syria, say, 2024, 2025? It seems incredibly messy.
Extremely fluid. After the reported fall of the Assad regime in late 2024, you had an HTS-led interim government emerge in some parts. Then, quite surprisingly, in March 2025, reports surfaced of a deal between the SDF and Damascus for SDF integration into state institutions.
How was that received internationally?
The U.S. and EU apparently welcomed it, possibly seeing a path to stability. But huge questions remain about how much decentralization would actually happen, and crucially, Turkish opposition. Ankara won't accept anything that preserves significant Kurdish autonomy on its border.
How did Turkey react?
Cautiously. Engaging with the HTS government, talking about refugee returns, but doubling down on fighting the PKK-YPG threat. They offered training to a new Syrian army, presumably excluding the SDF, and continued military operations against SDF targets.
Any signs of de-escalation?
Some unconfirmed reports mention serious efforts for a Turkey SDF ceasefire, but fighting between the SDF and Turkish SNA forces, including Turkmen factions, has continued sporadically. The whole situation is incredibly precarious.
Finally, let's bring it back to Turkey itself. The Kurdish issue there is the oldest and perhaps most deeply rooted of these conflicts. What's the recent picture?
It's a conflict that's shaped Turkey for over 40 years now. State policies have involved huge military campaigns, severe restrictions on Kurdish rights, banning pro-Kurdish parties, replacing elected Kurdish mayors, you name it.
But Kurdish movements have persisted.
Absolutely. Demands have evolved, often focusing now on greater cultural rights and autonomy within Turkey. But recently, 2024-2025, there have been some potentially major shifts, renewed peace talks.
Really? Between who?
Reports suggest renewed dialogue between the government and the PKK's imprisoned founder, Abdul Öcalan. Delegations from the main pro-Kurdish party, the DEM party, reportedly met with him.
And what came out of that?
In February 2025, Öcalan apparently called for the PKK to disarm, and then in March 2025, the PKK declared a unilateral ceasefire.
Why now? What are the potential motivations?
It's complex. Could be political strategy by President Erdogan. Could be the sheer cost and weariness of the conflict for everyone, including the Kurdish movement. Could be a reflection of Turkey's military effectiveness against the PKK recently. Probably a mix of factors.
But is it likely to hold? Previous peace processes failed.
Exactly. There's a lot of skepticism. Past attempts collapsed. There's no clear roadmap for disarmament and reintegration yet. And Turkish military operations haven't entirely stopped. So challenges remain. Huge ones.
And how could this situation inside Turkey potentially affect Turkmen communities in Iraq and Syria?
It's directly linked. Turkey has often supported Turkmen groups partly as a counterweight to Kurdish influence, especially PKK-linked influence. If a genuine, lasting peace takes hold within Turkey, Ankara's threat perception might change.
Meaning less need for Turkmen proxies.
Potentially, yes. They might rely less strategically on Turkmen groups in Iraq and Syria if the perceived PKK threat diminishes significantly. But the flip side is also true. If this peace process collapses and conflict flares up again inside Turkey, Ankara might double down on its alliances with Turkmen groups abroad to pressure Kurdish actors.
So the fate of Turkmen in Iraq and Syria is tied to the outcome of Turkey's internal Kurdish issue.
In many ways, yes. Their future position is significantly influenced by how Ankara decides to proceed with its own Kurdish question.
This has been, well, an incredibly complex tapestry we've tried to unpick today. The history, the contemporary dynamics between Kurds and Turkmen, it's shaped by centuries of empire, the chaos of nation-state formation, and constant external meddling.
It really is. You see everything from strategic alliances centuries ago to intense, bitter conflict today. Their relationship is just a vital window into the ethno-political maze of the Middle East.
And Kirkuk, as we kept coming back to, really embodies so much of it. The competing histories, the fight over resources, the way outside powers manipulate local tensions. It's all there.
Absolutely. And then you have the ongoing upheaval in Syria, plus this potential shift in Turkey's Kurdish issue.
Yeah.
It creates this period of profound uncertainty. We could be seeing major realignments across the region that will deeply affect both Kurds and Turkmen.
It feels like the only way forward involves moving past those historical grievances, somehow insulating local politics from external interference, and finding genuinely inclusive solutions. Solutions that recognize everyone's rights and aspirations.
That's the ideal, isn't it? Finding inclusive political pathways. But whether the political will exists among all the key players, local, regional, and international, to actually prioritize that over narrower interests, well, that remains the fundamental, critical question for the future.
A challenging note to end on, but a realistic one. Thank you for guiding us through this incredibly complex relationship. And for you listening, we really encourage you to keep exploring the rich history and the fast-moving current events shaping the lives of both Kurds and Turkmen. Maybe think about the long-term effects when states try to force a single identity, and how remarkably resilient distinct cultures and identities can be, even under immense pressure,